Well, good morning, church. If we haven't overlapped on a Sunday before, I'm Ben Clausen. I lead the college ministry here at Creekside. And man, it's just such a joy to get to be back up here with you guys this morning. I'm excited. We're going to discuss one of my favorite passages in the scriptures this morning, so I'm really, really excited. But before we do, I wanted to go ahead and tell you guys about Hannah, that's my wife, Hannah and I's garden that we've planted. We've planted a garden. So a few years ago, Hannah and I started going to there's like a local farmer's market in downtown Bryan every Saturday morning. It's amazing. We were like buying local produce. It was great. And we were like, you know, it's fun to eat broccoli that was harvested yesterday. So we sort of started to develop these dreams of like having our own garden. And we didn't have a house where we could plant a garden until recently. So when we moved into this house, some of those dreams sort of started to materialize in our minds. And we had this vision, this grandiose vision of like a full self-sustaining farm in our backyard, right? And I envisioned like rows upon rows of cauliflower and carrots, like tropical fruit trees around the perimeter of the yard. You're wading through corn stalks to get to our front door. That was sort of the vision. We got this, which, you know, you got to start somewhere. Got to start somewhere. And this little garden, I'm glad that I just started with this, because this little garden has been a test of all that is Christ-like within me. If you've gardened, you understand. This little raised bed, it's tested me. And what I've realized is I planted this garden. So I did the things that you do. I put all the soil in there, compost, et cetera, and planted these little plants. And for the first couple of weeks, I saw astounding growth. It was like all these little things that were this big started boop, 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 boop. But then at about week six, it was like it just froze. And it wasn't even like cold outside. It just stopped growing. And for like 2 months, I have had plants that have remained about an inch taller than that right there. So I've got like tons of broccoli leaves, but no broccoli. I've got like kale, but it's about yay high. So what I realized in gardening is that it's actually really frustrating when the garden that you plant doesn't produce the fruit that you desire, right? Because I planted this garden with the intent that it would bear much fruit and I would eat it. But the problem is it's sort of frozen. And I tell you that because one of the most common analogies or images that the scriptures use for the Christian life, for the thriving, productive Christian life, is this image of a vine that's bearing fruit. They use this image of fruit bearing for the Christian life. And essentially, I really do believe that every single one of us are meant to be, we are made by God to be fruit-bearing people. In Galatians chapter 5, many of you know this famous passage that speaks of the fruit of the Spirit. It speaks of the fruit of the Spirit as love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control, right? And those are things that I think that every single one of us desire for our lives, right? Like we want to be people of divine love, not worldly hate. We want to be people of unceasing joy, right? Not bottomless despair. We want to be people known by our circumstance surpassing peace, right? Not anxiety. We want to live in patience and not brashness. We want to be kind and not ruthless. We want goodness and not evil. We want faithfulness and not flakiness. We want gentleness and not harshness. We want self-control, not laziness in our lives. I believe that every single one of us want to see the Christian fruits produced in our own hearts. But the problem is, no matter how much we want fruit, we all realize that often we don't get it, that the garden that we plant doesn't produce the fruit that we desire, right? Like, I want to be a kind and loving husband to my wife, Hannah, and yet out comes that harsh tone. I want to be a kind and present and patient dad, and yet I find myself rushing through bedtime so I can get some me time. I want to be a kind, encouraging friend, and yet I am finding myself spending all my time with a friend, like complaining again, again, and again. And I'm sure I'm the only person that struggles with all this stuff, right? But what I realize is I really want the Christian fruits to exist in my life, but often I don't find them, right? So the question for today is what's going on there? Like, how do we actually live a life conducive to the fruits of the Spirit growing within us? How do we live a life that leads to fruit bearing? What sort of soil is necessary for the Christian fruits to be produced in our lives? That's the question for today. And I want to be really clear before we dive in to the passage that you and me cannot produce fruit. Like, it doesn't matter how hard we try, we cannot produce love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness, gentleness, and so on in our own hearts. We can't do it. It's sort of like you can take another gardening metaphor, growing an apple tree. Imagine you want to grow an apple tree. Can you make that apple tree grow from seed to big plant to producing apples? Absolutely not. You can't make an apple tree grow. You can't like tug on the stalk. You can't push out fruit yourself. You can't do anything to make an apple tree grow. But what you can do is set up conditions that are conducive to growth around that apple tree, right? Like you can plant it in a spot that has really good soil. You can water it as it needs. You can make sure it gets adequate sunlight. You can fertilize it. And in that way, you can contribute in a tiny way to that apple tree's growth. But you ultimately are not responsible for the fruit being produced. And I think that's a really good analogy for the way that fruit bearing works in the Christian life. We're not capable of being people who produce good fruit of love and joy and peace and so on. But what we are capable of is setting up conditions conducive to the Spirit producing that work in our lives. So today, what we're going to see in this passage that I just love, John chapter 15, is five steps to creating the conducive conditions to the Spirit growing in us, the fruit of the Spirit. So if you've got a Bible, we're going to be in John 15 today, John 15, and we're going to talk about the conducive soil to the fruits of the Spirit being grown within each and every one of us, within each and every one of us. And for some context, this passage that we're about to be in comes as a part of what's known as the Upper Room Discourse. The Upper Room Discourse is essentially Jesus' last teaching before he was arrested and killed. And as you would with anyone, if someone told you that they know that they're going to die at this point and sort of said, these are some of my last words, you should really listen to what that person says as their last words, especially when that person is God in flesh. So this is a significant teaching from Jesus. This is a wonderful teaching from Jesus. And a lot of people think that this teaching comes as the disciples, or the teaching does come as Jesus and the disciples are walking from the upper room all the way down to the Garden of Gethsemane. So a lot of people really think that this teaching where Jesus is going to talk about a vine and the branches happened in a vineyard, that they were walking through a vineyard and Jesus stopped. And in the moonlight, looking down at one of these vines, he lays out this analogy. And the picture that he's going to lay out is of a vine and branches and a vine dresser. He's going to say in verse 1 that he is the vine, that Jesus is the vine, and that you and me, Christians, were the branches. And the Father, God the Father, is the one who comes along and prunes that we might bear much fruit. He cares for the vine. So if you think about it in this picture right here, the vine is sort of like the woody stalk that grows up and splits off to the left and right. And then the branches are the things that the grapes and the leaves hang off of. So that's sort of the image that we're going with today that Jesus is going to describe. And he's going to say, listen, if that fruit is the fruit of the Spirit, what's it take for it to grow? And he's going to lay out five things, like I said. So join with me in John 15, chapter 15, verses 1 through 3, and we'll see the first thing. Jesus says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it might bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. Jesus says that the first step to the fruit-bearing life is that we have to allow pruning. We have to allow pruning in our lives. So let me back up to verse 1. Jesus lays out this analogy and says, I am the true vine. This is actually like a deeply scriptural thing that he's saying here because for many years, Israel, the nation of Israel, was seen as God's vine. It was one of the ways that they thought about their national identity. So if you look at Psalm 80, it describes Israel like this. It says, you brought a vine out of Egypt. You drove it out of the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground for it. It took deep root and filled the land. And then again in Hosea chapter 10, it's said of Israel, Israel is a luxuriant vine that yields its fruit. The more his fruit increased, the more his altars he built. As his country improved, he improved his pillars. Israel took this image of them being sort of God's vine so seriously that it was their national emblem. A golden vine was above the doors to the temple, apparently, and Israel's coin looked like this. And the emblem at the center, what you can see right there, is a vine. It's a grapevine. So what Israel was getting at is they were God's special possession. They were God's vine. But what you know of Israel as time goes on is that they were an unfaithful vine. They were an unfaithful vine. They kept straying away from God. They kept failing to produce the fruit that God desired. So God said this of them in Ezekiel chapter 15. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, like the wood of the vine among the trees of the forest, which I have given to the fire for fuel, so have I given up the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So what's interesting here is Israel proved to be this unfaithful vine. So when Jesus comes in the last of his I am statements in the book of John, what's he say of himself? What's true of himself? He says, I am the true vine. I am the true source through which fruit is actually grown. Not Israel, not anything else. It's me. I'm the one that leads to true, real, lasting fruit in God's people. That's what Jesus says. And he lays out that if he is the vine, his father is the vine dresser, and the vine dresser has two roles. So look back at verse 2. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. That's role number one. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes that it might bear more fruit. So the vine dresser here sort of does a couple of things, right? First, he removes the fruitless branches. And then second, he prunes the fruitful branches. And this verse, frankly, sometimes makes people go, uh-oh, so if I don't bear fruit, she's going to cut me off, throw me in the fire. That's what verse 6 says. And interpreters who looked at this verse, who have looked at this verse, sort of interpret it in three different ways throughout history. Option number one is that this could be referring to believers who lose their salvation because they don't bear fruit. Only problem with that, we believe that believers cannot lose their salvation, that we never earned our salvation in the first place, so we can't lose our salvation, right? We contribute nothing to our salvation except for need, as one of my seminary professors says. So it's not that. Option two could be that believers who don't produce fruit are sort of functionally worthless and get trimmed off, right? It's sort of like what James says in James chapter 2, that faith without works is dead, right? That's not saying that faith without works is non-existent, but what it is saying that functionally it's not really contributing much to the kingdom economy. If you're not working out, living out your salvation, it's not contributing much to God's kingdom. So maybe it could be referring to that. Or the third option is that it could be referring to non-believers who profess to be followers of Jesus but aren't really Christians. And the example that a lot of people lean on is Judas, right? Because actually at this exact same moment, Judas is betraying Jesus. And just a couple of chapters before in John chapter 13, Jesus was talking about this whole situation. He was talking about his disciples, and he said, but not all of you are genuine disciples. You seem like you are, but not all of you are genuine disciples. And then Judas would go on and betray Jesus. I think that that's what's happening here, that he's referring to non-believers who aren't really Christians, but maybe sort of seem like it, or they're in it for selfish reasons. I think that's what it's referring to. And when he says they're cut off, it means that they're just never members of the vine in the first place. They're not members of the vine in the first place. But the good news is, of course, if you don't want to be one of the branches that's cut off, the simple answer is you believe in Jesus. So if you believed in Jesus for the forgiveness of your sins, that he died on the cross, rose again 3 days later, this is not referring to you. It's not referring to you. But what I do want to point out that this verse makes really clear is that the obvious thing is that it's a bad situation when we're failing to bear fruit, right? Like, fruitlessness is not what Jesus wants for any of us. Fruitlessness is not what Jesus wants for any of us. But he goes on and points out, but again, I'm not referring to you, disciples. And that's why in verse 3, he says, already you are clean because of the word that I've spoken to you, right? Talking to his disciples who might have said, like, are you talking about us, Jesus? You're going to cut us off? And he's like, no. Already you are clean. You, my disciples, are clean because of the word that I've spoken to you. So that's sort of the first role of the Father. But then the second is that he prunes the fruitful branches. The Father prunes the fruitful branches. Why does he do that? So that they might bear more fruit. I did some research on viticulture, which apparently is the word for growing grapes and vines, in preparation for this sermon, and I found out that to prune a grapevine, that's what I Googled, how do you prune a grapevine, it's actually a ton of work. It's intense. It's a lot of work. Maybe some of you have done this before. I've never done this. My garden hasn't quite gotten to grapevine growing yet. Maybe one day, but it's a lot of work because in the on season, when it's growing, you have to almost every day go out and trim the leafy parts of the branches, and then you snip off any unwanted offshoots or branches. And you do this most days. And then during off season, you come along and you trim almost all of the branches all the way down to the nubs so that the next year they can grow fresh. It's a lot of work. But again, you do this because what you want is to focus the plant into grape growing, to focus the plant into grape growing. Because when you got a ton of leaves growing all off, it's taking nutrients from the grapes. Because when you've got a lot of different like offshoots, it's pulling nutrients from the grapes. So the goal is to channel all of this plant's energy into growing and producing grapes that lead to fruit, producing fruit. And similarly, I really do believe that this passage says that God comes along and he prunes our lives so that everything that pulls us and distracts us from fruit bearing, from Christ likeness, is gone, slowly slips away when we allow God to do so, when we allow pruning. I really believe that this is what it's saying, that God will come along and he'll snip off those old sin habits that we've gotten so used to, that he'll uproot the things that are just pulling us and distracting us from Jesus. And what a lot of us know about pruning from experience is that it really is a painful process. Pruning sometimes really, really hurts. Good thing plants don't feel pain when you prune them, but we certainly do. Pruning is often a really, really painful process for us. Hannah and I were actually just talking about this yesterday. We were doing some sort of year-end reflecting, and we were talking about how we really think that we just went through a serious season of pruning. We had a daughter 7 months ago. I know I don't talk about that very much, but we did. And during Hannah's pregnancy, we sort of started to realize some kind of scary stuff was going on. Like, we were going to the doctor most weeks, and Hannah was getting an ultrasound, and they were finding out that Ivy, that's our daughter, was measuring like really, really small. And every single week we went in and she was measuring smaller and smaller. So it was like 11th percentile, 8th percentile, and then eventually 3rd percentile. So they referred us to all of these different specialists, and Hannah was getting 2 ultrasounds a week, and it was really terrifying. And 1 week we went in and she was still in the 3rd percentile, and we were just like terrified about what this means, because a lot of time that can mean that their life is at risk. And I remember that Hannah and I were just left this doctor's appointment absolutely terrified, because there was zero zilch that we could do about this. You know, you can't contribute to your child's growth. So I remember we just like rallied all of our friends and community and the Creekside staff and our families around us and just said, please pray that this baby would grow. And I remember my mom sent a text and she was like, I have literally not stopped praying for baby Ivy. And it was this really beautiful moment that our friends and family rallied around us when we were terrified and desperately wanting this baby to grow, and we're just praying and praying and praying. And I still remember so distinctly the next week we went into this doctor's appointment and they did all the measurements and they said that she was in the 23rd percentile. And it was the biggest growth spurt that this doctor said he had ever seen in a baby in the womb ever. Because that's what God does, right? And I remember as I looked back on that season that it was really, really painful. It was hard. I was terrified. But at the same time, through that pain, God ripped out the weeds of self-reliance and of this need to control all of my circumstances. And in the place that those weeds once existed, he grew the fruit of dependence and belief in the power of his prayer. And that's the way the pruning works so many times in our lives. It might be painful, but through the pain, God's producing growth. You can think of a time as a kid that you were writhing around in bed with the pain of growth spurts, but you could have hope because that growing pain was leading to fruit. It was leading to fruit. And a lot of times that this is what God does in our lives. He doesn't give, all pain is not from God, but God has this mysterious way of using our pain to produce fruit. So the first thing that we have to do, if we want to see fruit bearing exist in our lives, is to allow God to prune us, allow pruning. And then the second thing that we have to do comes from verses 4 and 5, when Jesus says this, "Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself, unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing." Nothing. The second thing that we have to do if we want to live the fruit-bearing life is be with Jesus. Be with Jesus. Now, here's what I mean when I say be with Jesus. This word abide that Jesus uses here, maybe your translation says remain, it's the Greek word meno, and it's an intrinsically relational word. And this word essentially means to stay in the same place as another person. So if I invited you to come over to my house and stay in my guest bedroom for a couple of nights, I don't know why you'd want to do that, it's nothing special, but if I invited you to do that, you would be abiding in my house. You'd be remaining in my presence, staying where I am. And that's essentially what this verse right here is getting at. What Jesus is saying is if you want to experience fruit, you need to be with me. You need to be in my presence. And I love how he drills this in sort of both the negative and the positive, right? Like verses 4 and 5 are so repetitive, so repetitive. And when Jesus repeats something like this, you need to ask, well, why is he doing that? And I think it's because he really, really, really wants us to get this point. So look at how he drills it in the negative one more time. He says, abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I'm the vine, you're the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. But what can you do apart from me? Nothing. Zero. Zilch. Nada. You can't do anything apart from Jesus. I remember when I first started leading in ministry, one of my first ministry leadership roles was at Breakaway here in town, if you know Breakaway Ministries, when I was a student. And Timothy Atik, TA, was leading me at that time, and I remember he used this phrase over and over and over again that really sunk into my heart. He said, if we really take Jesus seriously here, like if we really believe that what Jesus says is true and right, then it is ridiculous, foolish even, for us to attempt to do anything apart from him, right? Like, why would we even try and do any good work in our lives apart from Jesus? He says it's impossible. You're not going to do anything. You're not going to do any good. But the converse is also true. Look what he says again, abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit apart from the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. Abide in me and I in you. I lost my spot. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. But with Jesus, when you're together with Jesus, we can bear much fruit. So the question is, what's the best thing that we can do if we want to bear fruit in our lives? If we want to be people who are excellent husbands and wives and parents and students and children and kingdom workers and employees and missionaries and leaders, whatever your role is, what's the best thing that you can do? The answer is it's not a marriage conference. It's not a leadership podcast. It's not 10 steps to being a highly effective student or child of God. A lot of those things are good, but the absolute best thing that we can do if we want to thrive and bear much fruit in all of your God-given roles is just be with Jesus. Just be in his presence. Just be in Jesus' presence. I can absolutely see this in my own life, right? I've got this accountability group that has two of my best friends, and we confess and share a ton of things most weeks with one another. And what we've noticed is this pattern that the weeks that we have a little bit more to confess, you know how you have those weeks? We can almost always trace back failure and sin to a lack of time spent with Jesus. But the converse is also true. When you really spend time with Jesus, or when we have weeks that, not that there's nothing to confess because we're not perfect, but on the weeks that like we really did experience circumstance surpassing peace, and we really were loving husbands and good dads, like those weeks we can almost trace directly back to our time spent with Jesus. And it's not a one-to-one, it doesn't always work like that. But what I've noticed in my own life, and I'm sure you've noticed in yours too, is it's proximity to the source that leads to fruit bearing. It's proximity to the source, to Jesus, that leads to any fruit bearing in our lives. I think this is epitomized by the truth of the Christian gospel, right? What's the gospel say? That apart from Jesus, what can we do? Nothing. Where were we when we were apart from Jesus? Ephesians chapter 2 says that we were dead in our sins and our trespasses. Apart from Jesus, we're stuck. We're dead. Dead person can't do much to get out of their scenario. But I love in Ephesians 2, it said, but God, because he was rich in mercy, made a way back to himself by dying the death that we deserved and then rising again on the third day. He paved a way back to himself, right? So now, apart from Jesus, what can we do? Absolutely nothing. We're stuck and dead, but with Jesus, new life. New life is possible. So essentially, if you want to live a fruit-bearing life, if you want a salvation-bringing life, the second thing that you got to do is just be with Jesus. Just be with Jesus. And then I love how he goes on to describe sort of what all of this entails in verses 7 and 8. Jesus said, if you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish and it will be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. The third thing that we have to do if we want to bear much fruit in our lives is imitate Jesus. So here's what he's saying here. He says, if you want to live a fruit-bearing life, you have to imitate me by abiding in me and my words abiding in you, and then you can ask whatever you wish and it will be done for you. So this is kind of exciting, right? Kind of an exciting verse. If I abide in Jesus, I can ask for whatever I want, like a boat. That's fun. All expenses paid vacation to Turks and Caicos. That sounds pretty nice. No, that's not what Jesus is saying here. He ain't no genie. That's not what Jesus is getting at here. What he's getting at is that if, notice there's an if you abide in me and my words abide in you, then you can ask whatever you want and it'll be done for you. Why does he say that? Because when you're really spending time with Jesus, really abiding in Jesus, you start to become like him. And as you become like him, you imitate him. You do the things that he would do. You say the things that he would say. You ask for the things that he would ask for. The line between who you are and who Jesus is just kind of slowly starts to blur as we abide in Jesus. I think this can be compared in a weird way to method acting. I don't know if you've heard of method acting before, but it's this controversial thing in Hollywood where an actor just essentially completely immerses themselves in the character to get in their role, to get in character, right? The actor Daniel Day-Lewis is the most famous for this because he does insane, impressive things to get into character, right? So once he was known for, he played a role as a Czechoslovakian brain surgeon, and he didn't want to sound like an American speaking Czech, so he learned Czech to get in role, to get in character. He played a prisoner in one role, so he spent 3 days in solitary confinement with nothing to eat or drink right before the filming. He was in a role about a movie that was about the 1750 French Indian War. And to prepare for it, he lived in the wilderness for a whole month. He was in a movie that was set in 1862. So he insisted on only wearing clothes specific to that time period. And his clothing was so inadequate for the winter in which that they were filming that he got pneumonia. And then he doubled down and refused to take modern medicine because he believed he was living in 1862. So he struggled with pneumonia for a long time. He played Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, in the film Lincoln. I haven't seen it, heard it's fantastic. And he was literally so into this role that he didn't break character for the entire 3 months of filming. And as he did, he made everyone on the set of this movie call him Mr. President, even offset, including director Steven Spielberg. So I just love this story because what Daniel Day-Lewis embodies here is that when he takes on a role, sort of the line between who he is and who the character is just kind of starts to blur. You kind of look at him, and you're like, are we sure that's not Abraham Lincoln on set? The line between who he is and who his character is just sort of starts to blur. And in a much more, right, beautiful and redemptive sense, this is sort of what happens when we spend time with Jesus over time. The line between who we are and who Jesus is just kind of sort of slowly starts to blur. And we become more like him. And the beautiful thing is the scriptures marinate in our heart and we're transformed more into his image. Again and again and again, we just start to ask for the things that he would ask for and the things that he already wants to give. We start asking, Jesus, would you save my friend who doesn't know you? Jesus, would you heal and move in my life? Jesus, would you well me up with your love? We start to ask for the things that Jesus is just waiting for you to ask him for, that he so desires to give to you. And that's why he says, ask whatever you wish and it'll be done for you. Because God is waiting to, zealous to answer prayers like that. That's why he says that here. The third thing that we have to do if we want to become like Jesus and bear much fruit is imitate Jesus. And then he goes on to ground this in reality. Okay, so what's all this look like? What's it really look like in the next verse, in verses 9 and 10? He says, as the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. The fourth thing that we have to do if we want to live the fruit-bearing life is do what Jesus said. Do what Jesus said to do. So look how he kind of builds this argument. He repeats the command to abide again in verse 9. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. Abide in my love. So I don't want us to miss something really profound happening here, right? What Jesus says here is that he loves us with the same love that the Father loves him with, right? Now that might seem like kind of a straightforward thing, but are any of you parents out there, maybe? I think there are a few of you. What sort of love do you feel for your kids? Think about it in like its purest and highest moment. That love that I feel toward my daughter has like brought tears to my eyes so many times. I, yes, have been made mushy by being a girl dad, for sure. But that love is really unlike any other love that I've experienced before. And what Jesus says here is that's the way that his father loves him, except made perfect and divine and amplified by the 10 billionth degree, right? And Jesus says that that way that the father loves him is the way that he, along with the father and the spirit, love you and love me. That is a incomprehensible amount of love that Jesus feels for us. And what he says here is that if you really feel that love, what I want you to do is remain in me. I don't want you to go anywhere. I just want you to stay right here in my presence and don't go looking for what can only be given to you by the Father anywhere else. Don't go looking for divine love anywhere else. But the question sort of is, well, Jesus, how do we do that? How do we abide in you and remain in your love? And he says it in the next verse. He says in verse 10, if you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. Jesus says, if you want to abide in me and bear much fruit, the path to doing so is obedience, is to obey my word, to obey Jesus' command. And what Jesus commanded, right, was to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, to love your neighbor as yourself, and to make disciples of all nations. Jesus says, when you do that, when you live out your faith, when you don't just believe these things in your head, but you actually practice them with your hands, with your lifestyle, that's when you abide in me, when you remain in me, when you love me, love others, and make disciples. That's the path to obedience. That's the path to abiding. It's a path to bearing fruit. I love that Jesus says this here. I love that Jesus says this here. And what it challenges me to is I've really got to know what Jesus commands me to do. And I've got to set out to obey the commands of Jesus. That is the path to abiding. And then he goes on to land it by saying, when you do these things, when you practice these things, the inevitable result is that something's going to happen that we see in verse 11. He says this, these things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. My joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. The last thing that we have to do if we want to live the fruit-bearing life is expect joy, There's this misconception about Christianity sometimes, right? And it's that we're prudes, we don't like to have any fun, and never experience any joy. It was once said of the Puritans that their greatest fear was that someone somewhere may be happy. And let me just make it really, really clear. With all of this discussion of obedience and love and fruit bearing and even pruning, the danger is that Jesus appears as a demanding taskmaster. And all of this is seen as a begrudging duty to be carried out through gritted teeth. That couldn't be the farthest from Jesus' real message. I love the quote from C.S. Lewis, that joy is the serious business of heaven. Joy is the serious business of heaven. And I think that's what this passage is getting at here. Jesus says, all of this I just said, that my divine and perfect joy might be in you and that your joy might be full. In fact, the opposite is the enemy's message. Remember John 10:10, when Jesus said, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy, but I, Jesus, have come that you might have life and have it abundantly. Have life and have it abundantly. So the point is, Jesus is interested in our joy. Jesus wants us to be filled up and overflowing with his joy, and joy is the byproduct of obedience. What he's saying here is that if you abide in me and remain near me and obey what I told you to do, the result is not going to be you get to the end of your life and say, man, that was exhausting. What a trip that was. But instead that you realize you get joy just welling up within you and overflowing. And when we say joy, Christian joy is not the same thing as happiness, right? He's not guaranteeing happiness is going to exist. What he's guaranteeing is that something deeper than that will. Christian or happiness is sort of a circumstance-dependent thing, but joy transcends circumstance. Christian joy is the spirit-given ability to see good no matter the circumstance, to be grateful no matter what comes your way. I love this poem from poet Jack Gilbert, who wrote a poem, A Brief for the Defense, and he speaks of circumstance surpassing joy like this, and I just love it. He says, we must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight and not joy. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world. To make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. We must admit that there will be music despite everything. I love this quote because what he's saying is, when you're really around Jesus, when you really spend time with Jesus, when you gaze on the beauty of his face, when you internalize the message that he really did beat death, when you really do believe that he's coming back to restore all things and undo all wrongs, when you really do believe this, that no matter what comes your way, joy will be the overflow of your heart, that we will believe that there will be music despite everything. I love that quote. So what he's saying here is that if we want to be people who are known by our fruit bearing, what we have to do is abide. We have to abide. And essentially, abiding is to allow pruning. Abiding is to be with Jesus. Abiding is to imitate Jesus. Abiding is to do what Jesus said. And abiding is to expect joy. So, oh, that we would be a church that abides. Oh, that the blank canvas of this year would be painted with abiding, right? I just wonder what God might want to do in you and me this year. If this really is a year that's marked by abiding, I wonder what fruit he might be waiting, zealous, excited to produce in us if this is a year marked by abiding.